It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Anthony Hamlet is marking 3 years on the job as superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, 3 years into his five-year plan for the district. He joins us in studio just ahead of a big Board of Education meeting later this evening. Dr. Hamlet, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you having us back.
Last September, you delivered a State of the District report in which you said transformational change is slow, difficult work. Where is the district now, one academic year after those remarks?
Well, I can tell you with preliminary data that we received from the PDA, from the state, our PSSA scores were up in every category. So we're continuing our progress toward 100% proficiency for all kids. We know that's going to take some time, but that's our charge as educators, to make sure all kids are 100% proficient. And we won't stop moving forward until that happens. But we are making steady progress.
And so you said there's preliminary data. Mm-hmm. Is that in the different grade levels that are tested?
Yes, that's overall. We're up in ELA. Overall, we're up in math as well. And also, overall, we're up in science.
Okay, ELA, English language,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Even if you say, and you use this term, I believe, it's a marathon, not a sprint, people want intermediary goals,
yes,
don't they?
Yes.
They want results. So what are you most proud of 3 years in, or even over the course of this last year from when we spoke earlier?
I would say, number one, you know, the crown jewel of public education is graduation. So I would say our graduation rate is up overall 80.8% up from about 69% over the years. Also, we're proud of our one of our most vulnerable populations, our African-American males. You know, a few years ago, the graduation rate was, I think, 57.4%. But now we're actually exceed the state in that area. We're at 73.5% graduation rate for African-American males. So we're proud of those numbers and what we're doing with those kids, but also all of our students as well.
Is it difficult to keep jumping that graduation rate up overall, because a lot of the efforts, it seems like to me, are put into the younger kids, the younger students, to get them engaged, to get them achieving at a younger level, third grade, fourth grade, et cetera. And so you see the fruits of that maybe later on, years down the road?
Yes, that's the key right now. One thing we don't want to continue to do is play catch up. Because playing catch up is tough, right? We want to make sure that we address the needs of the students earlier. So number one, they become more engaged in the academics. As they read better, they'd be more engaged in school, and they won't be embarrassed to come to school, and they won't be acting out more so. So we want to put all these supports, not everything, but major supports in place to make sure all of our kids are reading on grade level at third grade, by third grade.
Your five-year plan, did you have specific numbers of achievement or graduation in that plan? And are you hitting that, or at least hitting your marks 3 years into it?
I would say right now we're hitting the marks in the majority of the areas. Again, we have that preliminary data, and I need to pull it down and compare it to our KPIs, key performance indicators. So we have specific key performance indicators that the board has laid out that they want based on our strategic plan. And so that increases in every category, academic category, every year. But it also speaks to making sure we have equitable distribution of resources for students when it comes to kids of all colors being in advanced placement courses. And of course, you may know that we did a gifted screener, making sure a higher population of minority students are in gifted programming. So we're doing some work in those areas, and those are embedded in our KPIs as well. So right now, so we're actually meeting our marks in majority of those categories.
All right, in the majority. Where do you say we're not doing it, and we must do better here?
Yeah, so one of the things I'm going to call out is our suspension ratio.
That's gone down, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, so it's tricky, right? And so what we want to do is we want to decrease the disproportionality of the ratio between subgroups, right? Suspensions have gone down significantly, but we still have that ratio that we want to bring down as well.
African-American versus whites.
Yes. But of course, as you begin to reduce the number of suspensions, then it's going to kind of get condensed. We're actually doing a data analysis with our central office team next week, looking at our end-of-the-year school data, seeing exactly what we have to do, and begin to support and train people over the summertime to be ready and prepared to support these new efforts to reduce those ratios next year.
Dr. Hamlet, I do have to ask you about Cuba. Last month, the Board of Education hired an independent investigator to look into a trip that you and some other district administrators took to the Caribbean. The trip was actually to Florida with a side visit to Cuba. What was the purpose of the trip itself?
Well, right now, I've been told not to discuss that right now. It's under review. But I can tell you nothing was done unethical at all. Nothing was done egregiously. So that I can't tell you right now. But I can't speak any more about that.
All right. So there is an independent investigator that was hired, actually a former city solicitor, mm-hmm. now in private practice. Can you say what the trip was intended for, though?
No, I can't talk about it at all.
Did you know I was going to Cuba, a side trip, before you left?
I can't talk about it, Kevin.
Okay.
I can't tell you. No, I didn't know that.
You know, I'm sorry, you did?
No, I did not know
did
that.
Did not know that. Because that's very, that well, is important yeah. because Linda Wren, the Pittsburgh School Board president, signed off on it because it was intended to be a domestic trip and full board approval is needed for international travel.
I've been, while here with this board and in my 3 years, I've been internationally. So I know the process if that is told where we're going in advance. That wasn't done. So
separately, late last month, Pittsburgh Comptroller Michael Lamb filed a complaint with the State Ethics Commission saying you might have violated the State Ethics Act by not filing financial interest statements, including income sources. Did you file those statements?
Once I found out about it, I filed those statements. So I'll give you back information on that. So number one, my first year in, I signed the statement. So we have a process in place that those documents are generated by the legal department and given to us via in-office mail for individuals who need to sign it. For some reason, we didn't get those for 2 years. So the process that we have in place wasn't working somehow. So I'm taking this on administratively to make sure that we put a new process in place that's driven by administration in my office to make sure all individuals who need to sign will sign on a regular basis.
The attention, the public scrutiny, the media attention over the trip to Cuba, the ongoing investigation, the controller's complaint to the Ethics Commission, would you say that they've distracted you or even hampered your ability to do your job as superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools?
I would say, in my opinion, it seems that it was designed to be that way.
Designed it. I infer some opponents put some things out there?
I have no idea. I have no idea. You know, it's interesting is that, you know, I'm not the one who actually do the stories. So it just based on the media, you choose to do different stories. You choose to ask these questions. You choose to pursue things. So I would ask the question, why is there never anything good talked about? I can show you a plethora of data that we're doing great things in all these areas, but nothing gets talked about.
Well, we're talking about the improvement of graduation and the reading rates, et cetera. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Pittsburgh Public Schools Superintendent Anthony Hamlet. Pittsburgh School Board, it's scheduled to vote this evening on a plan to move 100 or so students, grades 6 through 8, at Pittsburgh Malines University Prep in the Hill District to Arsenal Middle School in Lawrenceville. Why the move?
You know, one of the schools that was a main focus coming in, and I heard a lot about, was Malines, and they wanted to get that school in order. Right now, as you look at our data and look at our performance of our middle school kids in Pittsburgh Malines, right now we feel that move can support our kids' growth because if you didn't know, Arsenal is a 5-year star school. So they show tremendous growth in their schools. So they have a star status, right? So it's 5 years. So they've been known to have a proven track record of growing students, and they have a high population of immigrant students who come who don't know English, but their growth, you know, they might not be proficient, but their growth as far as becoming literate readers and math and science and language arts far exceeds that at University Prep. But also, we're trying to create a real middle school environment that nurtures the middle school kids right now. And that we've been talking about this also. When you look at the model of a 6 through 12, when you look at the model of a K through 8, traditionally, all the focus in a 6 through 12 is on the 9 through 12 students, the high school students. And traditionally, in the K through 8, more of the focus is on K through 5.
Are you saying that the middle school students are like that middle child maybe getting attention?
Yes, I've said that before. And I, you know, even in my previous role, that the middle school students are like have middle child syndrome when it comes. And I think this is a problem across the nation. And I think we're working on putting more supports in there for our middle school kids because we realize if you didn't, that's a tough time. They're going through puberty. They're up and down every day. They don't know if you want to be your friend one day or your enemy the next day. So there are a lot of things that we need to support our students with growth wise when it comes to that middle school age. So we're looking at that, taking a deep dive in that and seeing what additional supports we can put in place, both academically, socially, emotionally as well.
So why not just take what's working at Arsenal and adapt it to University Prep?
Because oftentimes it's about the culture of the school and it's about the leadership of the school. Not saying anything's wrong with the leadership at Alliance, because we have a first year principal there who's doing some great things. But if we want this expeditiously to move faster, you will put the kids in an environment that's already thriving.
Why not just create more middle schools? You mentioned K through 8 and 6 through 12. Why not just create more middle schools in the district?
Well, right now, if we look at the historically, we used to have middle schools previously, but the right sizing era came and then a lot of schools were closed. They kind of hodgepodge some things, and they created these 6 through 12s, and they created these K through 8 schools, conceivably to save more money as you close down schools. But to me, based on the history and what I'm reading, there wasn't any real focus put on the needs of the students in the right-sizing process.
My colleague, Sarah Schneider, she spoke with Nina Esposito-Vizgaitis, head of the teachers' union, in advance of the vote this evening. She says that some parents and some board members are upset it's happening so quickly. Why the rush?
To get it done in time for next school year. And to that point, do we wait another year and have these kids in the same environment? Anybody's will want their child into the best environment that's going to support them in that process. So we look at it from a point of having a sense of urgency to do things. And at some point, you have to pull a trigger. But we've been having these conversations with particular board members for since last fall.
Do you think you got enough community input on this plan?
Well, you know what? We actually made sure we did our due diligence. We got a lot of community input, but also we actually went and knocked on doors of parents, and we called parents, and we have a lot of data of the parents in support of the move.
So you did individual contact, because I know you had some meetings,
yes,
and the attendance was not that
great. Right. That's why we made sure we went out ourselves, our community engagement department, knocked on doors, made phone calls.
If the plan is approved by the school board, any faculty or staff losing their jobs?
Nobody's losing their job at all.
Pittsburgh Public Schools Superintendent Anthony Hamlet, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I'm always ready and willing to come on to Confluence.
The school board meets tonight at 7 at its district office in Oakland. The public is invited to attend. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Ukrainian Room in the University of Pittsburgh's Cathedral of Learning is dedicated in 1990. The Baroque-style space is filled with carved wood, colorful ceramics, and intricate metalwork. Icons including St. Nicholas, the Mother of God, and St. George are featured throughout the room, and the door is also a chalkboard. Each piece represents a cultural aspect of Ukrainian life. There are 31 nationality rooms in the Cathedral of Learning. The newest is the Philippine Room, dedicated earlier this month. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Many people look into their family histories to get a sense of identity, but Black Americans often hit brick walls when doing this research. 90.5 WESA Sarah Bowden reports on how DNA testing can illuminate lost branches of a family tree.
Renalda Colvin has been researching her genealogy for well over a decade. She points to a beige cloth box about the size of a microwave.
This is all of my genealogy kit right here of everything that I have ever done.
The box contains copies of birth certificates, a will that lists enslaved ancestors, and old photographs, like a portrait of her great-great-grandfather as a young man. He wears a dark suit jacket and has somber round eyes.
His name is Sam Tucker, born and raised and died in South Carolina, and I believe he was born enslaved.
To learn the story of her family, Colvin says she's gathered oral histories in Alabama and South Carolina, searched for estate records on microfilm, requested files at government offices, and she recently sent away for a 23andMe DNA test. This will be the second time she's done genetic testing. She also has results from Ancestry DNA. Colvin decided to do additional testing after attending a workshop on African American genealogy at the Heinz History Center with about 75 other people.
How many people here have roots in, let's say, the Carolinas? Let me see a show of hands.
Michael Williams is a Pittsburgh-based genealogist.
How many here have any roots in Mississippi, Louisiana? Let me see a show of hands.
After testing with the company African Ancestry, Williams, who was adopted, was able to trace his matrilineal line all the way back to the Crew people, a historically seafaring group storied for their independence.
The fact that she survived the Middle Passage, whoever this Crew maternal ancestor of mine was, just nameless, her progeny ended up in North Carolina.
People can also test their patrilineal DNA. Because women were often raped by the white men who enslaved them. For many Black Americans, the patrilineal results show European lineage. This kind of testing only provides information for a single genetic line, which is just a small slice of information considering that a person has 128 great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. A third option for genetic testing is autosomal DNA, such as 23andMe. This product gives a complete look at one's genetic makeup, which genealogist Shannon Christmas says is particularly helpful for finding distant relatives.
Even if you are not looking, someone else is, and they're going to run across your name and begin to understand where you fit into their family.
A lot of people are interested in autosomal tests for what Christmas calls the genetic selfie.
Because they are so hypnotized by the marketing around, for lack of a better term, ethnicity.
I'm pulling up my ancestry.
Renelda Colvin scrolls on her phone.
It says Cameroon, Congo, and Southern Bantu peoples, 39%.
These ethnic breakdowns aren't all that accurate. For example, Colvin was originally told she was 30% Nigerian.
And now I'm like 3% Nigerian.
In contrast, Colvin says some of her white friends are more certain of their backgrounds.
It's like, oh, well, I know I'm a quarter German, a third of this, and and it's easy for them to identify who they are.
Colvin says it would be nice to know this information, but she's more curious about the generations who were enslaved and lived during the Jim Crow era. If she could talk to these relatives, Colvin says she would say thank you.
Because of what you had to endure, because of the pain, the suffering, the mishaps, history being unkind to you, thank you for all that you've done for me to be right here. And that I hope I can tell your story with dignity and pride.
With the results of her next DNA test, Colvin might find a distant cousin with whom to share these stories. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today marks 1 year since Antoine Rose, a Black unarmed teenager, was fatally shot by white police officer Michael Rosfeld, who fired as Rose fled a car that had been involved in a drive-by shooting. Rose's death was caught on video, but a jury acquitted the East Pittsburgh police officer of homicide in March. Rose was a student at Woodland Hills High School, where classmates continued to grapple with his death. Four of them spoke with 90.5 WESA about the past year, which brought them a new school principal, Philip Woods, and, they say, a greater sense of unity.
I found out about maybe 30 minutes after, because the video that was caught, it got posted online. And, yeah, I was just watching it over and over again because I surely didn't know what happened and just wonder who it was.
And I had like no idea that it was Antoine until I got home and I checked Facebook.
Oh, I was bawling my eyes out. I cried because this is not the first time that I actually lost somebody that was close to me or went to my school. So it's like, why is it always the kids in our school like dying?
It was really crazy to really think about, because whenever you think about stuff like this, like police brutality, you never really think it could happen to you until it really happens. And it's like, wow, like this is real life. And it's like, it's not a game out here. Like I look at these boys, like they're my brothers, like family to me. And it's like really scary knowing that there's nothing I can do to prevent from someone else taking one of my brother's life.
And it literally happened right in front of my uncle's house. Like, my uncle was outside while it happened. But then once I found, like, on the internet, they posted the video and stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's really, like, dang. I knew him since, like, he first moved around here, like, when we was kids. Like, we played football together and stuff.
Last year, I was in 10th grade, and he was a senior. Like, he was, like, trying to be my little boyfriend or whatever. He's definitely a sweetheart. Like, he's definitely, like, a flirt.
It doesn't matter who his friends was. It was the drama club to the football players, just white, black. It just didn't matter. It was just, everybody's cool, Antoine.
He's, like, funny. Very, very funny. He's always telling everyone to, like, always do good and stuff like that.
Whenever the trial was going on and, like, the verdict was happening, I was at work. Me, personally, and some other people I'm around, we weren't surprised.
It makes me so mad because we never get any justice, and that's why I said most of us weren't surprised.
My mom called me. My mom screamed my name downstairs. So I got on to my mom crying and stuff. And me, knowing, like, everything I know about, like, the system and my uncles and people I know that went to jail, it's just, like, I already knew that what was going to happen before it happened.
The next day, there was an announcement saying, if anybody feels some type of way, if anybody's hurting right now, come to the auditorium, and we're going to talk about it. And that's what we did. Antoine's mom came and spoke to us, and she just vented to us and told us, stay in school, do what Antoine couldn't do.
That's all you heard about throughout the whole year, just Antoine. People just bring it up. Like, all the time.
This is, like, all year. Everyone still talks about it because stuff like this that really happened, like, it's really serious. And the one thing that I do applaud Dr. Woods is that he allows us to have a safe and comfortable space to talk about.
He really came and really, like, enforced, like, we're going to be better. We're going to show them that we're not weak and we're going to be strong. We lose people. We've been losing people, every other month for a long time. I lost two of my closest friends. So it's just like, and I lost my brother when I was in middle school.
Woodland Hills is not a bad school. I just want to put that out there for the media and everybody else, because our rep is bad. But we are working as a community and as a district to be the best that we can.
If you're not here living this life that we're living every day, losing the people that we're losing, and seeing the stuff that we're seeing, just don't speak on it. Because at the end of the day, we got each other, and we're going to be all right.
My name is Jeremy Thomas Jr.
My name is Taylor Moore.
My name is Jeffrey Williams III.
My name is Plazania Tegan, and I go to Woodland Hills.
90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley and Anli Herring produced this piece in collaboration with the Narrative Justice After School program. I'm Kevin Gavin. Stay with us as we explore whether the community has begun to heal and changes in policing. That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The evening of June 19, 2018, Antoine Rose II, an unarmed 17-year-old black male, was shot and killed during a traffic stop by a white East Pittsburgh police officer. Both his death and the acquittal of the former officer who killed him inspired demonstrations, sorrow, anger, frustration. Has the community begun to heal? And how have policy and policing changed or not changed 1 year later? We're going to talk about all that with Farouk Al-Sayed, Director of Operations for One Hood Media, Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Megan Guza, who covers public safety, and David Harris, WESA's legal analyst, a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and the host of the Criminal and Justice Podcast. Welcome, all of you, to The Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Hello.
Thank you.
We just heard from several former classmates of Antoine Rose. But what's your sense of how the broader community is doing today? Farouk, let's start with you.
I think that to begin with, you know, a year later, we're kind of here at this intersection, and we're viewing the climate of the city. And the youth are feeling in a place where they've been feeling, we've all kind of echoed the sentiments that, like, you know, in Pittsburgh specifically and across the nation, that black lives don't matter. And with how everything has been, you know, reported, with the trial being about Antoine and not Michael Rosefeld, we have seen that, you know, they criminalize a black boy for dying. And we're still reeling from that. And right now, I think that a year later, we're still feeling those sentiments. We're still feeling the impact. We're still grieving. The community's still grieving. It's very apparent. And unfortunately, it's kind of like, I know with me, kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Because we know Antoine won't be the last one. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just really a matter of time. If you think about, if you look in the national way, that how many black people, unarmed black people, have been killed by police just in the year span. And it's still happening. This is still an issue. So, you know, those children just echoing the sentiments of the community.
Do you feel any sense of hope, though?
I mean, you know, you never want to just walk around with that cloud over you of this despair and depression. But, like, you can hope that things will get better, but we'll see.
Okay. Megan, you spoke with several people for the report you did along with your colleague Jamie Martinez. What were you hearing in the lead up to the one-year anniversary today?
The thing that really struck me leading up to, you know, we're a year later, is that these conversations are still happening with the same kind of fervor and frequency as they were, you know, 364 days ago. They're still going, and they haven't dropped off. A lot of times you'll see, you know, kind of the conversations fade as time moves on, the news cycle moves on, and they're still going. People are still grieving, they're still angry, and they still want change.
Was there a specific comment from somebody for your reporting that sort of really stuck out to you about that feeling? Whether it was a musician who wrote lyrics or something like that?
We did speak with some members of a band, Wild Blue Yonder, who wrote a song called Angels Prevail. And while it's not just about Antoine, it's about kind of the cumulative trauma that the kids in Woodland Hills have been feeling, watching, you know, classmate after classmate be lost to violence. And just really realizing how much this has affected these kids. They're growing up in the violence, and a lot of them are still hopeful for change.
The shooting touched off protests and demonstrations from downtown to East Liberty, outside municipal buildings, and even onto the Parkway East. People wanted answers. They needed to grieve. 1 year later, how do you think has the conversation changed? And if so, how so? Farouk and then David.
I think in terms of the change that we have, you know, we've I know with One Hood specifically, we've allowed people to platforms to voice these opinions. We've gone to lobby for legislation against, you know, the use of force laws. We've made it an issue to discuss what really murdered him. Was it the system or was it the human being? Was it a combination of both? And it was. And I think with these laws, to go back to your first question, if you asked me if I felt like there's hope, I don't feel that there's going to be hope if anything changes until the systemic issues and the policing changes. Once the policing changes, then that can change. And we can have conversations about that all day. But that is that right now commands the most attention. Can we get a change about the conversation, and can we get a change about the policy? Those are the biggest things.
David?
I do think that there's been a change in terms of how people see this issue, because you couldn't look at the crowds that were demonstrating and the people who have appeared lobbying, as Farouk said, and not notice that it is not simply African-American people. It is people across all demographics. People are beginning to see that this is an issue for everyone who lives in the region if we want to have a good, safe, strong place to live. And so it's a realization that this is a deep issue for everybody who lives in Pittsburgh, not just, quote, some people. The other thing I think you could really notice is that the anger has not been just motivating people to have a strong demonstration. They have, as Farouk says, they have gotten behind changes in the law, in police procedure. They have looked at this systemically and not just as one incident. And that is the thing that can make a difference. If you have sustained energy behind those kinds of ideas, you can have long-term change. Though it will take a while, that's the beginning of long-term change.
Change. Farouk mentioned it, conversations, yes, but based on change. David, as you look back, has there, in this past year, have there been any substantive, tangible changes to whether it's hiring practices or requirements for background checks of possible officers?
Well, that conversation has started in law enforcement. I mean, all you'd have to do as a person in law enforcement is look at one fact. The East Pittsburgh Police Department, where Officer Rossfeld was employed, that's gone. It is out of business. It is dissolved. And those smaller police departments that maybe don't have policy, don't have good training, who might believe that they are made up of good people, but they are just not sustainable in their current form. They're having a hard look at themselves. And that kind of change is coming. I think they all know it. And what we've seen so far is a greater interest in policy and having the right kind of standards and best practices. Those things can't happen overnight. They're just not of that nature, but they are beginning to happen.
Is there an appetite? I mean, you're saying the conversation started about change, but is there an appetite for change, whether it's Harrisburg or nationally?
Not necessarily everywhere, but there is enough of an appetite. It is starting. There is energy behind it. You can see it at every level, from district attorney elections, where there was suddenly interest in offices that were long incumbency offices. This is Philly. This is even, there was an election here, a primary election in Pittsburgh. You see it in police departments, large and small. You see attention being given to these issues. You know, this is a huge battleship we're trying to change and turn. So I know change is due and overdue, but we're working on it, and things will come around. It's just that this is we're working within a system of policing in America that is highly hyper-localized, and that makes change hard.
Megan Guzin, you're reporting about police departments because you cover public safety, you cover policing. Have you noticed any, have you heard any conversations about change within, I mean, we have like 100 police departments in Allegheny County alone.
And I think that's a big topic of conversation. There are so many police departments, and they aren't necessarily uniform in how they do their jobs, how they police the communities they work in. And as David said, you know, East Pittsburgh Police Department doesn't exist anymore. And there are other departments that are looking into going the same way. I know there were conversations in North Braddock. And some of them are realizing, you know, this isn't sustainable. This is not the best thing for the community or for, you know, a small borough's finances.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're discussing healing efforts within the community and proposed changes in policing 1 year after Antoine Rose, an unarmed black teen, was shot and killed by a police officer. I want to talk now about use of force. For now, Pennsylvania's law says, and quote, an officer is justified in killing someone if they believe it's necessary to prevent death or bodily injury, or if they believe the person has committed a forcible felony and such force is necessary to prevent someone from escaping. Farouk, what would you like this law to say instead?
We have to first establish what fear is for these officers. There's no way, I've been doing martial arts for 27 years, there's no way a person can threaten you from running away from you. So the definition of fear, what is a responsible reaction to someone running away from you, we need to change and enforce that. Secondly, I would like it to say that the use of force can, if you look at other countries, me as a Canadian, right? Our use of force law is completely different than the American use of force law. It's completely different in England. It's completely different all across the world. There are literally dozens and dozens of countries setting a precedent and standard for peaceful arrest for non-lethal tactics that have not been employed in the United States of America. Pennsylvania is a commonwealth. They can make up laws how they want. But this use of force law is basically just a justification to shoot and kill black people from marginalized communities. That's what this has done.
And joining us in the conversation now is Brandy Fisher. Brandy is the president of the Alliance for Police Accountability. Brandy, we're talking about proposed change, the current state law on use of force, and also proposed changes. What would you like the use of force law to say instead of what it currently does?
We are still currently looking at language that would be sufficient across the board, in our opinion. But it's the vagueness of the law that's saying what is opposed to what is necessary, and then also requiring de-escalation being a tactic before any other force.
David Harris, a couple of Pittsburgh area state lawmakers, Summer Lee, Ed Gainey, have proposed changes that would eliminate the language that says force may be used to prevent an escape and mandating that police officers use other tactics before killing someone. Does that go far enough?
It's certainly the right direction. And I've talked to Representative Gainey myself. In fact, called him right after he appeared here on the Confluence not long ago and offered him the example of the proposal that's been in the legislature in the state of Maryland. That proposal would effectively mandate that officers must try other things that have been discussed here by both Brandy and Farouk, that they have to try types of de-escalation. Asking, did they do anything that actually amped the conversation, the confrontation up? And so if you write those kinds of things into the law, policing will have to change as a response. I think that would be the right approach.
Do other states do it differently, other jurisdictions?
Most states do it more or less like Pennsylvania does, and that's because all the states have been effectively setting the bar fairly low with the Supreme Court's decision from the 1980s in Graham versus Connor, which is just objectively reasonable. That's all it is. And like Brandy said, that's pretty vague, and it allows for a lot of consideration of fear, as Farouk was saying. What we need are laws that reflect the reality we want to see. And that is, I think, the direction we can go. Maryland's proposal is a good example.
And another possible change out of this is a proposal before county council for a countywide police review board. David, I know you advised on this or made some suggestions,
yes.
But police departments would have to opt in.
That's the big problem with the way things are right now. Unless state law changes, the county can't make the many, many small departments in the county participate. The county police would participate, but it would be up to those other small police departments to decide whether to participate. The positive aspect of this is that the structure is created and it's there for when either the state law changes or there's more pressure on these small police departments to come in from their own communities. There's a place for them to go and start.
Very briefly, Megan, there's been criticism about the demographic makeup of the Pittsburgh department. How might greater diversity on the largest force in this region affect outcomes, do you think?
I mean, you always want to strive for your department to look like the communities that you're policing. And that makeup is not there in Pittsburgh right now. And that can affect outside of Pittsburgh as well, because so many Pittsburgh police officers do go on to work in county police, other boroughs, that type of thing.
We have just a minute left, and my final question is this. Short term, Brandy, briefly, what would you like to see happen next?
As a whole, I would love to see this use of force law passed. Secondly, I would love to have our attorney general and people on the state level do more about policing, because there are too many different departments, too many different municipalities to continue to go on department by department. Also, we would like to see laws that require police officers to be drug tested across the board, because that does not happen, and to stop using canines to attack people.
In a sentence or two, Farouk, what would you like to see happen next?
I would like to echo Brandy's sentiments. Like, the use of force law definitely needs to be changed. The biggest thing was, you know, community-wise, whether it's legislation, whatnot, we need to view these black children as black children, not black men, not black threats, not super predators. We need to view them as human beings and children that deserve the respect and dignity that other children do.
And, David, what feasibly could happen next?
The use of force law should be drafted and put into the hopper so people can react to it and begin acting on it. And I would like to see some of these local police departments consider consolidating into regional departments. Everybody likes local until things go terribly wrong. I'd like to see that continue. And most importantly, I want to see everybody consider every kid in this county as if that kid were their own, not depending on what they look like.
Megan Guza, as a reporter, how are you going to be covering all that? What issues will you be focusing on?
I think it's just a matter of listening to the conversation that's happening, listening to all sides and facilitating conversation as well, because some of these people on all sides of this issue might not normally, you know, come face to face, speak to each other. So just
kind of helping to move the conversation forward, facilitate it, and just listening.
Megan Guza is a Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter. She covers public safety. Brandi Fisher is the president of the Alliance for Police Accountability. Farouk Al-Sayed is director of operations for One Hood Media. And David Harris is WESA's legal analyst. He's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and he hosts the Criminal Injustice Podcast. Thanks to all of you for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.